July, what, 15th, I guess the 15th, we continue with our next class. Did you get the handout from the front over there? This is our second in the series, The Temple in Its Glory, the second of three. And last time, for those who were here, we began with the Kotel today, and we talked about the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash. And then we moved on to the actual Beis HaMikdash itself, the temple itself, which you have in your handout, and we have a blow-up over here on the board. And last time we got up to, even though we have all these sticky things on the one here, we got up to the steps that go from the Ezra section to the women's section up to the rest of the Beis HaMikdash. So we're going to work tonight. We're going to start with the steps and move our way toward the Kodesh HaKodesh and the Holy of Holies. The goal is tonight to complete that, so that next time, a week from tonight, we can talk about what the experience was of being in the Beis HaMikdash at that time, the miracles that you saw on a daily basis, etc. Whatever we don't complete tonight, we will carry over to next time. Now let's begin then with these steps that go from the Ezra Kashim up to the next level. Remember we said last time that the Beis HaMikdash is on a mountain, it's Har HaBayis, it's the Temple Mount, so you are constantly ascending as you move from the areas that are less sanctified to the areas that are more sanctified. So as you're moving into the inner sanctuaries over here, you're going to continually move up and up and up. So those steps, how many steps were there?
15.
There were 15, and they correspond to? Okay, the Shir HaMalos that were written by David HaMelech, by King David in Psalms, in Tehillim, those Shir HaMalos, he composed 15 of them, and those 15, when King Solomon, his son, built the Beis HaMikdash, he put in 15 steps. I want to pause here for a moment and deal with a question that Dina Conover asked me today. She stopped me as she was driving out of the parking lot today. It's a good point she brought up. She asked, why is it that we focus on the second Beis HaMikdash, the second temple, why not the first or the third? How come all of our discussion is about the second? So the answer to that is, it's not a very complicated answer, it's actually a pragmatic answer. The answer is because this is the one we have the most information about. The first Beis HaMikdash, the information we have comes from the psukim, from the verses, primarily in Sefer Malachim, in the Book of Kings. The third Beis HaMikdash, the information we have comes from the psukim in Yechezkel. The second Beis HaMikdash, which is the one that we have, the diagram of and the information that I'm trying to impart to you, this all comes primarily from Mishnayos, because there are sages of the Mishnah who actually not only saw the temple, but did service in the temple. Certain of the sages, for instance, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, who was one of the Rabbeim of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva had two primary Rabbeim, two primary teachers, Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Yeshua was a Levi, and he worked in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash itself. So we actually have eyewitness accounts of what it looked like and what they did. And that's why we focus on the second temple, because that's the one that we have the most information about, we're able to deal with the most background. That's what we do with that. Did you get a handout? Did they hand that over here for anybody who... Okay, I think that's that. Okay. So, the 15 steps that were constructed, David HaMelech is the one who came up with the number 15. The story behind that, many of you may be familiar with, but we'll review it now because it's relevant to our diagram over here, that even though it is Shlomo HaMelech who built the Beis HaMikdash, David HaMelech, King David, actually laid the foundation for the first temple. And when he laid the foundation for the first temple, he had to begin by digging the shisin. What are the shisin? The shisin are deep holes in the ground that are directly beneath the large mizbeach, the large altar, which we haven't gotten to yet. We will discuss those holes in the ground when we get to the altar. But and why there is need for holes in the ground, we'll talk about when we get to that point. But he was digging those holes that would be necessary, that hole that was necessary for the altar, for the mizbeach. And it says in the Gemara that at that time he uncovered the Evan Shisia. Evan Shisia means the stone of, I don't even know how best to translate the word Shisia. we can call it the, not cornerstone, but the stone, the foundation stone of the world, which is located there under the Mizbeach. And when he uncovered it, the Gemara tells us that the Tahom, the depths, the waters that are beneath the earth, not oceans or rivers, but well beneath the earth, began to come up and come out through that deep hole, and it threatened to flood the whole water, the whole world. And through a series, a whole story over there with Achitophel, there was a whole discussion in the Gemara over there, which we're not going to continue with now, but eventually David HaMelech managed to stop the waters from coming up very high, and the waters actually receded, and they receded, the Gemara tells us, 16 mil, a mil is 2,000 amos, 2,000 cubits, 16 of those, which would be 32,000 mil, beneath the surface of the world. That was too much. For if the waters are that receded, then the ground is too dry, and then crops cannot grow. So David HaMelech then recited, he composed the 15 Shir HaMalos that we have in Tehillim, and for each one of the Shir HaMalos, the waters rose another mil, another 2,000 amos. And after 15 of them, then the waters got to the right equilibrium, which is exactly one mil beneath the surface of the earth, whatever that means, wherever we're measuring from, I'm not sure. So that's what the Gemara tells us, and that's the 15 Shir HaMalos. So corresponding to those 15 Shir HaMalos that David HaMelech composed, Shlomo HaMelech, his son, built 15 steps, which would bring you from the large meeting area where most people would come to when they entered the temple, the Beit HaMikdash. Those steps would take you from there into the main sanctuary, the inner sanctuary. That would be the main stairway. On that stairway, what happened on those stairs? Okay, the Levim sang songs. They sang shiros and tishbachos, praises to Hashem on those steps. Now, here's an interesting point that is not so well understood. The Levim, they sang, and what else did they do? They played instruments. Could a non-Levi sing or play instruments? It was permitted for non-Levim to walk over here. Both men and women were permitted to walk over there. So could a non-Levi sing or play instruments? What's that? Okay. So here, there was a difference of opinion. To sing, everybody agrees only a Levi could do it. And that was it. No one else was allowed to do it. Not only that, but the Levim themselves were subdivided into different categories. Some Levim were singers, and other Levim were gatekeepers. If you were a gatekeeper, you weren't allowed to sing. If you were a singer, you weren't allowed to be a gatekeeper. You had a very specific job, and you had to keep that particular job. So the Levim would sing. If you were not a Levi, you could not sing. This is Tony's wondering whether a Kohen could sing, since a Kohen is also a Levi. And that would be relevant. Mr. Shandere Familia should be rebuilt. Speedily in our days, that'll be a relevant question. I suspect, I don't know this for a fact, but I suspect that a Kohen could sing because a Kohen is also a Levi, but I don't know for a fact. But at any rate, the Levim sang and no one else could sing. Whether non-Levim could play instruments, if you were a gifted musician, could you play instruments? This is a difference of opinion in the Gemara. There are several opinions. Some say yes, some say no. Some say yes, but only certain people. It varies. So that we'll find out hopefully, as I said, speedily in our days. Yes?
Is that determined
in hereditary position? In other words, their children would be... It seems that it was a hereditary position. I'm not 100% sure about that, but it seems that the Levim, whatever family were the singers, they remained singers, and whatever were gatekeepers, they remained gatekeepers. The Levim stored their instruments in compartments that were located under the steps. Since there were 15 steps, that's a whole other floor. And so in compartments directly beneath the steps, I'm looking in this side, in this model here, but there isn't really a place for it here either. But under the steps there were some compartments where they stored their instruments. Now when you ascended those steps and moved on to the main sanctuary, there were now several entrances into the main sanctuary. For this, I'm going to hold up this model over here so we can see how many entrances there were. Now, there is a difference of opinion about how many entrances. This one, this model, has the opinion that attributed the most entrances. If you notice, we're starting only from this half until here, because this is the main area, not back here. So in the main area, you have 1, 2, 3, and 4. 4 on the north side, 2 on the west side, 4 more on the south side, 1, 2, 3, 4, the steps fell off over here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 4 more over here, so that's a total of 10, and then on the east side, and this is harder to see, it'll be easier to see in the handout, which I will hold up in a moment, well, actually I use the board over here, there are another 3, 1, and then 2 and 3 on either side of the main door, there were 2 other ones. So for a total, this would be a total of 13 different entrances to the main sanctuary, the main area of the temple. 13 entrances. Each entrance had a specific use. We are not going to go through each and every one tonight. It will be far too tedious. But, for instance, as we talked about last time, the men and women in the Beis HaMikdash would certainly remain separate. And so, in order to affect that, when men would bring sacrifices, they would enter through one of the entrances. When women would bring sacrifices, they would enter through a different entrance. So there were different ways of entering the temple. But that only requires 2. If there were 13, obviously you have to have other reasons as well. There were some types of karbanos, some types of sacrifices that would require a specific entrance. Others would have a different entrance. There was one specific entrance. Here she has it marked off, Shar HaMayim. That's the entrance here, the entrance of the water. That would be the entrance through which they would go when it was the time for Nisuch HaMayim, for the libations of water, which was only done when? Sukkot. The libations of wine was done every day, but libations of water, the pouring of the water, was only done on Sukkot. This is the entrance through which they would go for that particular ritual. Why there? That's the whole discussion in and of itself. That's not for this evening. But there would be, each entrance had its own particular use. The most famous entrance is the main entrance over here, which is called Shar Nikanor. Shar Nikanor, the gate of Nikanor, is called Shar Nikanor because the person who constructed the gate's name was Nikanor. That was his name. What was so special about Nicanor's gates? Again, many of you may know this story, but the Gemara tells us it starts with a Mishnah and the Gemara elaborates. The Gemara tells us that when the Jews first built the Second Temple, they were not very wealthy. They had just emerged from Galus, from exile, from the Babylonian exile, and now they constructed a temple. Well, they didn't have a lot of money, and so most of the entrances were made out of bronze, out of copper. But later, when they became wealthy, they changed the entrances to gold, which is what you would expect. You take the temple, you want the temple to be the nicest structure that there is, and so they changed it to gold. The exception was Shar Nikanor. The gates of Nikanor remained copper. They did not change it to gold. Why? Says the Gemara, for 2 reasons. One is because that particular copper shone like gold. It glowed like gold. You couldn't tell the difference. It looked like it was gold, even though it was only copper. So that was one reason. Why did that happen then? And that's because of the second reason, which is a miracle that took place with Nicanor's gates. He constructed 2 gates. He had gone to Alexandria in Egypt, where the best gate manufacturers were, and he commissioned the most beautiful gates to be built for the temple, because he felt that the temple only deserved the best. Then they loaded these gates up into a boat, and he sailed the Mediterranean back to Israel in order to bring his gates to the temple. On the way, there was a terrible storm, and because of the storm, they had to lighten the load of the boat, so they took one of the gates and threw it overboard. The storm was still threatening to drown the boat, to sink the boat, so they began to take the second gate, and they were going to throw that into the ocean. At that point, Nicanor couldn't take it anymore, and he wrapped himself around the gate, and he said, if you throw this over, you're going to throw me with it. And when he said that, the storm stopped. That was the miracle. But the miracle didn't end there. They finally got to Akko, to the port, and when they got there, they found that the first gate that they had thrown out was trailing behind the boat. And they got both gates. And so both gates were put up in the temple, and as a result, they didn't want to take down those gates because of the miracle that happened. It was special, so they left those gates. Anytime a person entered the temple through the main sanctuary, you were greeted by 15 steps, which would evoke for you memories of what happened with King David. And then when you would see the gates of Nicanor, that would evoke for you the story of Nicanor. So there were these symbolisms and memories that you would have in entering the temple, which spoke to you every time. The 15 steps, these incredibly beautiful gates of Nicanor. The other entrance that we're going to speak about is this entrance up here, which is called the Beit HaMelechim. It wasn't just an entrance. This was an entire structure, which you can see on your handout as well. Hold it up to show you where we are over here. But it's called Beit HaMoked. I will explain that in a moment. Right here. Beit HaMoked means the house of the bonfire. Beit HaMoked, the house of the fire. That was an entrance into the temple, but it was actually a rather large building. It was roofed. Remember, we talked about how most of the temple was not roofed. This one was roofed. And in this area, there was an entrance that went from outside the temple. In other words, from the courtyard over here, you had one entrance to enter into the Beit HaMoked. That would be on the north side. And then, on the south side of the Beit HaMoked, you had another one which would actually get you into the main sanctuary of the temple. Now the Beit HaMoked served as I don't want to use the word lounge, but as a place where the Kohanim would be if they weren't actually serving at that time. The Kohanim, as many of you probably know, were subdivided into 24 groups of Kohanim, 24 families. And each family would serve another week of the year. So roughly, each family would serve 2 weeks a year. Sometimes three, most of the time 2 weeks a year. It wasn't every Kohen in the world serving at the same time. But that particular family, when they were on duty, not every Kohen worked at the same time, except for certain days of the year when it was all hands on deck. Like, for instance, Erev Pesach. Right before Pesach, it was all hands on deck. But when it was a typical day of the year, they weren't all working simultaneously, and this would be the room where Kohanim would kind of come and go. Now that room was also where the keys of the temple were kept. At night, the temple was locked up. It was locked up, and in fact, not only was it locked up, but the main, I keep calling this the main sanctuary, but as you enter to the Holy and Holy of Holies, the door to get into the Holy, that particular door was locked in a very elaborate way. And hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about that, just how that key worked. It wasn't easy to unlock. But the entire complex was locked up at night. Not only was it locked up at night, but you had Kohanim and Levim who were on duty all night, every night, guarding the temple. You had Levim guarding in the areas that were not sanctified, areas that Levim were allowed to walk in, and then you had Kohanim guarding in places that were sanctified. This guard duty was very serious. If a person was caught napping on the job, they had very serious ways of dealing with that person. The Mishnah relates a story how one of the Levim fell asleep. Somebody talks about his brother having fallen asleep on the job, and the way that they woke him up was by giving him... Now, don't get scared. It wasn't dangerous. It was just a way of making a point. But they would actually ignite his clothing. Now, it wasn't dangerous to the point where he could get hurt by it, but it would give him a sudden jolt, and obviously they then put it out. But it was a way of making it clear that this was not something that you did. You don't fall asleep when you're on guard duty in the Holy Temple. It was to such an extent that there was a certain place in the temple. You notice the temple has all around the wall, you have the upper area of the wall. Well, there was a certain point, part of the temple, where it says that the Levim guarded, and according to one opinion, the Levim who guarded up there were actually archers who guarded up there with weapons to protect against anybody coming to the temple at night. In the morning, there was a whole elaborate system for unlocking the temple and making sure nothing was disturbed overnight. The point of entry in the morning was through the Beis HaMoked, because in the Beis HaMoked you had Kohanim sleeping on one side and Leviim sleeping on the other side, guarding either side, and the keys were with the Kohanim. They were locked into their Beis HaMoked with the keys to the whole temple in this area. In the morning, they would then go out of the Beis HaMoked and go around the perimeter of the main sanctuary, making sure that nothing was disturbed overnight. Yes? They would sleep in there. There were not beds, there were rows of stone. There were places to sleep. The elderly Kohanim would sleep on the rows of stone, and the young Kohanim would sleep on the floor. That's what was there. I don't know. To watch, yes. But you had those who were on guard duty all night, and then you had those who were waiting for the morning, which is when they would begin to serve. Right, and they would be in there. Yeah.
So the other Kohanim, though, had their
Yes. Correct. Correct. When it was your week to be on duty, then you were there the entire time. Later, they were subdivided into seven. Each family was subdivided into a separate day. So you actually ended up with one day that you had to be there, provided that you were ritually pure. If it so happened that a Kohen was not able to be there, he couldn't be there. But that was, you know, you don't want to miss your chance. Excuse me. This Beit HaMoked had four rooms. It's hard to see. Oh, we can't see it over here.
Let's just mark them A, B, C, and D. These little rooms here off in the corners
of the Beit HaMoked. What was each of those rooms for? One room was to hold the sheep for the Karban Tamid, for the sacrifice that was given daily. The Karban Tamid was the sacrifice that was offered every day, one sheep in the morning and one sheep in the afternoon. It had to be the very first sacrifice of the day and the very last sacrifice of the day, every day. Didn't matter what day of the year it was, Shabbos, Yontif, Yom Kippur, didn't make a difference. The Karban Tamid was consistent. You had one sheep in the morning, one sheep in the afternoon. One of the reasons why we fast on Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, on the 17th of Tammuz, is because Batel HaTamid, because that was the day when that constant sacrifice was stopped. And so that becomes a very serious day. It's a very important karban that went on for hundreds of years without a break, that there was this sacrifice offered first in the morning, then in the afternoon. Now the sacrifices have to be free of any blemish. They have to be animals that are complete and not without any blemishes. So they had to be checked. And after they were checked and determined to be okay, they had to be washed to make sure nothing happened to them. There was always a supply of at least six sheep on hand in the Beis HaMikdash, and it was kept in this room over here for until they were needed. So that each day, at least two were used and two were brought in to replace the two that were used. And that was a holding room of at least six sheep, so there was always at least a three-day supply of sheep in that room for the Karban Tamid. That's the function of one of these rooms. Another one of those rooms was where they baked the lechem hapanim, the showbread, the bread that went on the shulchan, on the table, which is already further in, we haven't gotten there yet, which is located in the kodesh, in the holy, over here. That bread was baked in the room over here, in the room of the Beis HaMoked. That's where it was baked. A third room was interesting, that the Mishnah doesn't tell us any other function other than that it was used to hold the stones after the Hanukkah story, and the Mithyavim, the Hellenists had defiled the altar, then the altar had to be, the stones had to be replaced and rebuilt. Those stones were sanctified, but they were now impure. You couldn't just throw them away. So they were kept in the third room of the Beis HaMoked. And finally, the fourth room was a room that had a stairwell, and it descended into a tunnel beneath the temple, and that was where there was both there was a mikvah down there. As we mentioned last time, there were actually several mikvahs in and around the temple, but there was a mikvah, and there also was a bathroom down underneath this room over here, out of the temple and underneath. There was also a passageway that would lead the person out of the actual complex. That if a Kohen had to leave because of impurity and could not serve that day, he would be able to go out in that direction. In the temple, we have several kelim, several utensils, of which you will find the same utensils in the Mishkan as well, in the tabernacle. And in the Psukim, in the verses, in Parashas Terumah, you will find these kelim discussed in great detail. Those kelim are the Aron, the ark. You have the menorah, which is on the south side of the holy over here. You have the shulchan, which is on the north side of the holy, the table that holds the lechem upon the shulchan. You have the mizbeach hazav, which is here. That's the gold altar, which was not used for sacrifices. Who knows what it was used for? For ketoreth. It was used for incense, for burning incense. You have the large mizbeach, the large altar out here, which of course was used for sacrifices. That was the main mizbeach, and that was used with the ramp on the south of it, and the mizbeach itself. We'll discuss that in a moment. And you had the kiar. What is the kiar? That's the basin, that's the sink, that they would wash their hands and feet. All the service in the temple was performed barefoot. If a Kohen would wear shoes, the performance of his performance of the service would be invalid. It would be pasul. His feet had to touch the ground in order for the service to be kosher. That kiar is located here, and that's where every Kohen, before he would begin any service, would have to wash his hands and feet. In addition to going to the mikvah, they would also have to wash their hands and feet in the kiar as the service is located here.
Is there a stringent water supply like the mikvah?
Where does the water supply come from?
Yeah.
So the water supply was not a running water supply. It was a very large tub that was full of water, which apparently would last the whole day. But at night, there was a pulley system set up, and they would lower the kiar into a deep well that had at the bottom of it fresh water. And the kiar would stay there for the evening, and then they would bring it up in the morning full of water. That's the way it worked every day. In fact, one of the very first things that the Kohen did when checking the perimeter of the sanctuary to make sure nothing had happened is he would pull the kiar out of the ditch in order out of the well to have the water ready, because everybody needed the water in order to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. The altar, the mizbeach, was very, very large. The top of the bottom, the altar actually was a cube, not a cube, it was a square, and as the altar went higher and higher, it moved in a little bit. There were little ledges as it moved up and up. The very bottom of it was 32 amos by 32 amos. An ama is between a foot and a half and 2 feet. So we're talking about between 48 and 64 feet. That's how, so let's take the smaller amount, it's about 50 feet by 50 feet. That was the bottom of the altar. It was a little bit smaller on top. So it was a rather large area. How large is this room? What do you think this year? Yeah, about 50 feet. So you have the picture of this room square. So the top of the altar was very, very large, for people to walk around on it. The Kohanim did their service, they actually were on top of the altar. The fire on the altar did not cover the entire altar. There were several fires. The main one was right in the middle of the altar, but there were several fires at the same time burning on top of the altar, and there was plenty of room for the Kohanim to walk around on top of the altar. And so there's a whole elaborate system for the animals are slaughtered on the floor of the temple, and then they are skinned, and then they are brought up to the altar. The parts of the animal that have to be burnt are burnt. The parts of the animals that are eaten by people are eaten by people, etc. And so the main area, the focal point of service, was the altar, and that's where everything was going on. Yeah.
Friday.
Every day, including Friday and Shabbos.
So all year round? And so was it cold?
Yeah. It was cold. The floor of the temple was constructed of marble. And the Kohanim were barefoot. So it was very common. They actually had a doctor on staff. The Mishnah tells us who the doctor was. There was a doctor on staff because the Kohanim, since they were barefoot, and they would eat meat and flour with oil, you know, bread with oil, they would often have stomach ailments. And so they had a doctor on staff to supply them with Tums, or whatever the equivalent of those days was. Whatever they needed to eat. And there was no roof, that's correct. We mentioned last time, there was no roof over most of the temple. Most of it had no roof. We haven't gotten to the area that has a roof. What happened if it rained? So one of the miracles, which we're going to discuss hopefully next time, is that the fire never went out, even when it rained. That was one of the miracles, that even when it rained, even a downpour, it would not put out the fire on the altar. It is an aveira, it is a sin to deliberately put out the fire of the altar. But if it rains, that's not our fault. But one of the miracles was that it would not put it out, the rain would not extinguish that fire.
So this is a 24-hour fire all the time?
Yeah.
It was a
ner tamid, as we have in our shoals. That's what it was.
It was.
Yeah, we had to feed it. Right. We had to feed it. That's correct. Yeah. Was it built what? At the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, they copied as much as they could the first Beis HaMikdash. So I don't think there was anything in the second Beis HaMikdash that was radically different from the first. But they had parts that they had to do differently because they didn't have everything. For instance, they didn't have the Aron. They didn't have the Ark. So what do you do when there's no Ark? So, but at the time when the Beis HaMikdash was built, the second Beis HaMikdash was built, there were still prophets. Prophecy ended around the time of the completion of the second Beis HaMikdash, which means it didn't just suddenly end. It means those who were prophets remained prophets until they died. But there were no new prophets coming up the system. So within the first, whatever you want to say, 50, 60, 70 years of the second temple, there were still prophets. And there certainly were the Anshei Knesset HaGadol, the men of the Great Assembly, who were great sages and were able to figure out what to do. Yeah.
Mind-boggling. If the animals were killed on the floor,
was
the whole animal
relative domain? No. What they did is, that's what I'm going to describe to you here, is that what are these things, it's hard to draw these diagrams. Here, these circles are actually rings in the ground, metal rings in the ground, that were used to hold the animal's head steady while they slaughtered the animal, because if the animal would move suddenly, then that could invalidate the slaughtering of the animal. Today, in a regular slaughterhouse, when they have to shecht an animal properly, they have to hold the animal in place. They have an elaborate system to do that, and here in the temple, they would have these rings to hold the animal's head in place for the time of the slaughter. Next to the rings were cables and hooks where they could both skin the animal and also cut it into its parts, because it would be too heavy to carry an animal up as is. So even an animal which was a carbon ola, even a sacrifice that is completely consumed by fire where no one eats any part of it, even that type of sacrifice was first cut up into specific pieces before carried individually up the ramp to be burned on top of the altar.
Can I wave all of those parts?
No, some parts had to be waved, some parts didn't have to be waved, and not every sacrifice had to be waved. Waving, what does waving mean? You know, waving? What does waving mean? Waving, when you see that term, waving is exactly what we do with a lulav and esrog. The same thing we do with a lulav and esrog, that's waving. That's what it means. So when they have not an animal, but parts of the animal that had to be waved, they would wave it. The same way we do with the lulav and esrog, that's what they would do with whatever parts had to be waved. Usually with certain fats of the animal had to be waved, certain parts had to be burned, had to be waved first.
Is there a time frame for how you slaughtered and actually waved it then?
It all had to be done that day. So it was all... they didn't want to let it sit. They had other,
Blood was dripping in the...
Okay. There was a lot of blood in the Beis HaMikdash. Obviously, if you're still slaughtering, I mean, any slaughterhouse today, I assume most people in this room have not been to a slaughterhouse as I have, for those who it doesn't bother, there was obviously a lot of blood. Today, in a slaughterhouse, they slaughter animals over a drain. So what do they do in the temple? So in the temple, it's true there was a lot of blood, but they had a way of spongia for the temple. How was spongia done in the temple? How did they mop the floors of the temple? Well, there was actually a live stream running through the temple. There was actually a stream of water running through the temple, from, I don't remember if it's north to south or south to north. I believe it was widthwise through the temple. And that stream, it wasn't a very wide stream, it was running water through the temple. When they wanted to clean the temple, which was done frequently, they would simply stop it up at its outgoing part, and that way it would simply overflow its rut in the ground, and it would cover the floor with water, and then they would unplug it, and it would wash away whatever had to be washed away. That was the way it was done. But washing feet was before they served in the temple. Now, I want to point out, let's digress here for just a very quick moment, that, you know, it sounds pretty messy, and it was pretty messy. We talk about the service in the temple, we talk about it in a very innocuous way, but when you really think about it, it was a lot of blood and guts. I mean, that's what it was. It was a slaughterhouse. So there was a lot going on over there. We're going to see that one of the miracles was no flies. No flies in the temple. That was one of the miracles. Because you would imagine, if there's blood and guts, you're going to have flies. It's going to be a smelly, disgusting place. That was not the case in the temple. But it was messy. It was messy. So, but the Kohanim who served in the temple got their hands dirty and their feet dirty. They got dirty. It was a dirty job. I mean, it was messy. It got all over you. The Gemara speaks about a Kohen who was finicky and didn't want to get messy, and he used to wear gloves. The Gemara says he was punished severely for that offense. That is a bizayon that is degrading God's service. We like to stay clean when we're supposed to be clean, but when God says, get your hands dirty, we get our hands dirty. And here, God says to the Kohanim, get your hands dirty. And they're expected to get their hands dirty in the service of Hashem. Yeah.
When they did the service, did they wear white garments, or they wore unclean garments over
there? They wore their priestly garments. They had to wear the priestly garments, otherwise the service was invalid. They had to wear those garments. The garments were not white, not all of them.
Okay.
Some were white, some were not, depending on the garments. The regular Kohen, most of the garments were white. That is correct.
That would get pretty...
Yeah. Well, those garments had to be cleaned and had to be kept carefully. Yep, you're right. You're right. Yeah.
Everything was done in the temple. That Hashem told us that's written in the Chumash.
It's in the Chumash and also the Torah Shebaal Peh in the Oral Torah.
But we can't do those things on
Shabbos. You're asking that some of the service was a violation of Shabbos, like slaughtering. So you're right. We can't do that which the Torah doesn't say to do. There are certain things the Torah says you're allowed to do on Shabbos. For example, what happens when a baby boy is born on Shabbos, and the bris comes out on Shabbos? Now, normally, that sort of surgical procedure would be prohibited on Shabbos. A circumcision, a bris milah, would normally be prohibited, but the Torah says, do it on Shabbos. The sacrifices that had to be run on Shabbos, the same thing. The Torah says, do it on Shabbos. So whatever had to be done, the Torah says to do it on Shabbos, or Yom Tif, or Yom Kippur, you know, whatever the Torah says.
Things that were done,
correct. Right. But some of the things that were done we can't do. That's correct. That's correct.
Because
it's part of
the temple?
What's that?
Because it was only for the temple.
Correct. That's correct. Just like a bris milah. If a person has elective surgery, they can't do it on Shabbos. Right? But bris milah, Hashem says, do it on Shabbos. So it depends on what had to be done on Shabbos was done. That is primarily referring to the construction of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle. That's primarily what it's referring to. There is a discussion whether it might also be referring to some of the things that were done in the service of the Mishkan, but it is primarily the Lamites Malachos, the 39 acts of work that are prohibited on Shabbos, are derived from primarily the construction of the Mishkan. Like, for example, dyeing the wool to make them into the curtains of the Mishkan. That's where we learn the malacha of soveya, of dyeing, of coloring. We learn from that act. That wasn't one of the acts of service of the Mishkan. That was an act of constructing the Mishkan.
Well,
yeah.
The soldier had an opportunity, if he was reading, or had a new house, new ark, he did not deserve. What about the priest? They couldn't deal with blood.
The Kohanim did not have other things to do. I mean, this was the main thing to do, was sacrificing animals. That was and not just sacrificing, but dealing with the animals that had been sacrificed. That was the main job. The only job that is permitted for a non-Kohen is the slaughtering of an animal. A non-Kohen could slaughter it. Now, most of the time, the Kohanim did it, because they were the experts. They did it every day. But if someone was an expert, a non-Kohen, he could slaughter his own sacrifice, if he wanted to. Today, anybody can. Any Jew.
On Shabbos.
What's that? No, not on Shabbos. But I mean, a Shochet today does not have to be a Kohen. Anybody can slaughter an animal.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
What did the Kohanim do the other weeks
of the year that they wanted? They had a day job. They had a day job. They had a, you know, they had a, either that or they studied Torah, you know, whatever they, you know, whatever they did. Now, there were certain times of the year where they needed more Kohanim. As I said, Erev Pesach, before Pesach, they needed everybody. Usually on Yontif, they needed everybody. There were a lot of sacrifices on Yontif. So Kohanim who were not, it wasn't their turn to work, would still come to help out on those special days. The altar itself, the Mizbeach itself, had a, I don't even know the right word for it, but had the lowest level. As I told you, the altar, it was a series of smaller and smaller squares. Even the top one was very, very large, but it got larger as you got to the bottom. The very bottom one was actually it had a small groove in it, a ditch in it. That's where the blood would go that was actually thrown onto the altar. In the service of the temple, you have to throw certain types of blood at certain times onto the altar. Not on top of the altar, but on the sides of it, in the corners. The blood would then go down into this ditch, and it would empty into the shisin. It would empty into that those ditches that I told you that are beneath the level of the altar. In addition, on top of the altar, there were two small, the Gemara actually calls them nostrils, two small holes. One was for the libation of wine, and one was for the libation of water. The one for the libation of wine was wider than the one for water, so that if they were done simultaneously with the same amount, they would go down at the same time, because water drains faster than wine. Wine is thicker than water. And so those two nostrils, it would drain underneath the Mizbeach and go into the sheets and go into those holes that were those very deep ditches that were underneath the Mizbeach, underneath the altar. It's interesting to know, yes? How many? One, two, three. I want to say four. I want to say four, but I don't remember. I don't remember offhand. I want to say four. They don't draw it so perfectly here. I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly, but I want to say four. Yeah, the model does not have it. They only have one extra level. They don't have all the levels clearly marked over there. It's hard to see it anyway, but they don't really have it all set up over there. Now, an interesting point, this is rather fascinating to me anyway, is that the temple, who owned the temple? Who owned it? Okay, everybody owned it. All of Klal Yisrael, all the Jewish people, the land that it was constructed on was not owned by any particular person. It was purchased by David HaMelech, by King David, from Arazna Hayavusi. He purchased it from that person. The story is told at the end of Sefer Shmuel, and he used money that was collected from all the Jewish people so that it was owned by everybody. It was not one person. However, we know that the land of Israel was divided up into 12 parts, for each of the tribes had their own section. Whose section was the temple in? It was Binyamin. It was in the section of Binyamin. He's the one who merited having the temple in his section. It seems that he deserved this because he's the only one of the tribes who did not bow to Haman. He's the only one of the tribes who did not bow to Esav. When Yaakov met up with Esav in Parashat Vayishlach, when he met up with Esav, Binyamin wasn't yet born. And all the tribes bowed to Esav. Binyamin wasn't born yet, so he did not bow, which is why Mordechai was able not to bow to Haman, because he was a descendant of Binyamin. It seems that that's why Binyamin merited to have it in his section. Now, which parts? Was it all in Binyamin's section? Well, Binyamin, directly to the south of Binyamin, is Yehuda. And Yehuda and Binyamin, now you understand that sections don't have exact lines along a line of latitude. It doesn't work, you know, these sections kind of go up and down, and they're, you know, like any border. So Binyamin and Yehuda, their border was right next to each other, and they actually cut through the temple. Binyamin had all of the main parts, all of the holy parts, and Yehuda had some of the parts towards the east, which are less sanctified. Yehuda's section included the east part of the east wall of the altar and the south wall of the altar. Where the rest of the altar was owned by Binyamin, owned, it was in his section, but the line of demarcation between Yehuda and Binyamin ran right along the south and east side of the altar. That is why this ditch that I'm telling you about, that is on the very bottom of the altar, only ran along the west and southern walls. Because if it would have gone along the east and south walls, they would have been in the section of Yehuda, and the sanctified section has to be in the portion of Binyamin. And so that one little piece of the altar was not square. It was only along the west and southern perimeter of the altar. He had what? You're asking about Pelegis Begiva. We'll have to have a class one day about Pelegis Begiva. Maybe next summer. That's a whole discussion of it. So that we can't. That's in Shoftim. That's in Sefer Shoftim. That's a good question. But that's in Sefer Shoftim. That's a whole discussion. Moving along. I'm sorry, I missed one point, and that is that where could non-Kohanim walk, and where could you not walk unless you were a Kohen? Well, that line of demarcation is right here. These lines here were a line of demarcation. If you were not a Kohen, you could come up to this point. There were steps there, so you couldn't make a mistake. When you got to that point, if you were not a Kohen like me, you'd have to stop. If you were a Kohen and you were holy, you're pure, you could go beyond this point. At this point where only Kohanim can go, that's where they would duchen. As we have today, where the Kohanim stand on in Chutz Laaretz, outside of Israel, only on Yontif, while in Israel every day, so I kind of stand in front of everybody and they duchen. That is done in the temple. That's where it comes from. And this is where they stand. They stand up here, which is a platform that's raised above the area, the steps over here, as I said. And that's where they would stand and bless everybody who was there. So they would be here, they would be out here. Whoever was around would be blessed by the Kohanim standing over there. You know that when the Kohanim today, when they duchen, when they do Birchas Kohanim, when they bless us, the custom is to cover our eyes. The men put the talus over their eyes, the women close their eyes, not to look, my daughters told me, I don't know what goes on, my daughters told me they hold their sitter in front of their face. So, fine. Why do we do that? Why do we cover our eyes and not look at the Kohanim when they are duchening? So, the reason why we don't do it is because when they bench us, when they bless us, it is appropriate to think and concentrate on the words that they are saying and not stare at them, because what they're doing looks interesting. You know, the fingers and the whole business, right? So it looks very interesting. So if we would look at them, we would be distracted and then we wouldn't concentrate on the words that they're saying. And therefore, we are supposed to cover our faces, our eyes, not to look at the Kohanim while they are duchening. It is inappropriate to turn one's back. That one should not do, but one should remain forward but cover their faces, cover their eyes, or close their eyes. That's true today. in the temple, there was a much more important reason not to look, and that's because when the Kohanim would duchen in the temple, the Shekhinah, whatever that means, Hashem's divine presence, would rest on their hands. And it was actually physically dangerous for one's eyes to look at the Kohen's hands while they were duchening. And so there, they had to cover their eyes in order not to get hurt. Today, we do it in order to be able to concentrate on what it is that they are saying. But that's the reason why they would do it. As a result, the Kohanim in the time of the temple, when they would duchen, they would raise their hands above their heads because God's presence, divine presence, was on their hands. So to put it down here would be a design, would be degrading. And therefore they would raise their hands above their heads as a sign of respect for the Shekhinah, for God's divine presence, which was on their hands. Some say, with the exception of the Kohen Gadol, because since the Kohen Gadol wore that tzitz, he wore the headband, the golden headband, that said Kodesh LaHashem, holy to Hashem, sanctified to Hashem, and had God's name written on the tzitz, he would not pick his hands above the level of the tzitz of that headband. So he would have it a little bit lower than the other Kohanim who would pick their hands up above their heads when they would duchen.
Well, I'll give you an answer
to the talus. I'm telling you, I have no idea really what's going on. Their hands are under the talus and they're like this.
Yeah.
It's under the talus, yeah. It's under the talus. That's the way they do it, yeah. And their faces are covered too. That's the way they do it today. Yeah. Okay, we're about to get to the other Mizbeach now. One would then, if one could, which none of us could, because none of us are Kohanim, one would then ascend the steps and enter the beginnings of the real main sanctuary, the Holy and the Holy of Holies. We're going to have to move through this a little bit quickly because it's almost 8:30. But there are a few points here. First of all, in this first area,
let me make a point. Anybody here from Congregation Ariel? Okay, Congregation Ariel. Ariel means what?
Lion of Hashem.
Lion of Hashem. What is the original Ariel? The Beis HaMikdash is called Ariel. Why is the Beis HaMikdash called Ariel? Because the main part of the Beis HaMikdash, which is the...
So hard to see things in. I'm going to just run my finger along where it goes. The main part is this. This is the main part. And it appears like a crouching lion. And that's why it's called Ariel. This area, which is the main part, is called Ariel. The first area here of Ariel is the place where the knives were kept. You needed knives. Knives were kept in that area for the slaughtering of the animals. There were all kinds of compartments and areas in the Beis HaMikdash. There's some that we skipped where they kept salt for salting of the hides of the animals. There was a place where they kept the clothing of the Kohanim. The Kohanim had their clothing. They became dirty very often, soiled, and they needed other clothing. And there were different sizes for different Kohanim. They had to fit properly. So the clothing was also kept in a certain place in the temple. There were different areas that were designated for each vital part of the service. This first door over here,
which you can see now. Actually, you know what? This is even easier to tell, I think. There's your Ariel. I mean, that's what it looked like. Right, there's the roof of Ariel. This is the only part that was roofed. This is the only part of the building that was actually roofed. And it had two floors. You had the main floor, and there was a second floor. And that we're going to have to talk about, I think, next time to discuss what happens or what has happened on that second floor.
This entranceway into the main sanctuary was an imposing entranceway. It was double the size of the other entranceways, both height and width. It was a beautiful, beautiful entranceway. They don't have it over here, but they were on top of it, different designs, and it was a very beautiful and awesome entranceway, which would be appropriate when you're entering the main part of Hashem's sanctuary. When one went further, as I mentioned, back to this door over here, this door entered the holy. There was a very elaborate doorway that one could only unlock, let me see if I can remember correctly, there were two keyholes. There were two keyholes. One was a regular keyhole that needed a key, and the other, there was a hole in the wall, the wall, that was arm's width. And you had to stick your arm in and down to get to the other keyhole. And you had to do them both at the same time in order to open the door. It was a very elaborate system in order to keep the door locked. Yeah. Only what?
Only the Kohen, so ever.
Kohen, and if you were privileged to have a special job of? Not gatekeeper. No, because gatekeeper couldn't, the Levium couldn't walk over here. No, but everybody needs maintenance. Not maintenance to clean the floors. But what if there was a job to be, what if a wall had to be fixed? What if there was a leak? What if something needed to be fixed? Who did that? So that we have still to talk about. Even in the Kodesh HaKadosh, in the Holy of Holies, which no one was allowed to go into except for the Kohen Gadol and only on Yom Kippur, what if there was a leak? Someone had to fix it. I always wondered, how do they know there was a leak? But okay, that's a separate question. But how do you fix a problem in the Kodesh HaKadosh? That is the whole system that Mishnah speaks about. And if you were the fix-it man, you got to go in. But it wasn't so simple. That we'll try to remember to talk about next time. Okay. Let me just tell you what we will be covering next time before we discuss the miracles. We're going to be discussing, Mitzvah Hashem, the Holy and the Holy of Holies, which means we have to cover the menorah and the shulchan, the table, and the mizbeach, the altar inside. We have to cover the separation between the Holy and the Holy of Holies, the ark itself, which is in the Holy of Holies. We have to discuss the rooms that are around the main sanctuary church, around the Holy and the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKadoshim. We discussed those rooms and the ramp that was used to go up to the roof, and what is the second floor, and how does one fix these things if there's something that breaks. All of this we will cover Bli Neder next time, and that should take less than half the class next time, and then we will move on to, as I said, the experience of entering the temple at that time. Yeah. Yeah. I forgot to mention about the Beit Hamokid. I said it was a bonfire. There was a fire in the middle of the Beit Hamokid. In the Beit Hamokid, there was a fire. It was a fire that went all the time. That's where they would warm themselves up. Their feet were cold from walking on the floor. They would go into the Beit Hamokid and warm up at the fire. Yes, go ahead.
So the Levium were on one side, the
Kohanim
on the other side, and the
Kohanim
had the key. What was the separation
between the Levium and the Kohanim? I believe that the Levium were outside of the Beit HaMokid at night. I'm talking about at night. Oh. The Levium were here while the Kohanim were in here. The Kohanim slept on the stone on the floor that underneath it were the keys. And there was one room which had those six sheep constantly there. Okay, to be continued.